Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Did you know solar eclipses can make animals freak out? I didn't know that. What else don't we know about the eclipse that's coming on Monday? What will it be like here? Where to watch it and where not to watch it? Is it worth cramming into Oregon to see the total eclipse? What is an eclipse question that you have? We will answer it for you in 30 minutes. So call it in now, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869, or tweet at us at KUOW. Now, before you start picturing the eclipse, we're going to begin this hour by picturing something much more familiar, especially here in the Puget Sound area. Picture an extreme introvert with glasses, taped together glasses, coding in their parents' basement. Or a software engineer who wears sandals and a hoodie to work, yet is wealthy enough to own an airplane for personal use. My next guest says that those are two major stereotypes of people who work in tech. And she says not only are those stereotypes wrong, they are dangerous. New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller has written an article called Tech's Damaging Myth of the Loner Genius Nerd. Claire, welcome to KUOW.
It's great to be here.
And we've all seen the loner genius nerd in pop culture. Did it used to be true?
So one of the most interesting things I found out when reporting this is that it was never true. This has always sort of been the stereotype ever since the computer industry really took off in the 60s and 70s and people started making movies and writing books about it. There's always been the stereotype, but it was never true. It really started, programming really started in university computer labs at places like Stanford and MIT, and they were very social places where people, you know, worked overnight ordering Chinese food and pizza delivery and talking about what they were working on. And then later in Silicon Valley garages, it's never has it really been about doing this all on your own.
Isn't coding more solitary than a lot of jobs? I have a friend whose husband is a software engineer, and he works by himself at home, and he's does it for hours at a time, long into the night. Is there no useful truth in that?
Sure, there are pieces of the job, really just like most jobs, that are solitary. But the people who I've talked to who work in the industry, and I bet the software engineer would say the same thing, is that a lot of it involves a lot more teamwork than you might realize. There is stuff like, you need to coordinate with the legal department or the PR department when you're making a product, but you also need to work with your fellow engineers. One of the things you do when you write code is it goes into a code base that hundreds or thousands of engineers will use, maybe years later, long after you're gone. So even if you are not, talking with them as you're building it, you need to write it and name the things that you build in a way that other people will be able to work on them later. So there's a lot of teamwork involved.
And I opened up, Claire, by saying that this myth is not only wrong, but it's dangerous. What do you mean by that?
What it does is it really attracts people into the industry who maybe don't feel so comfortable working with other people, don't feel the need to work on those skills in themselves. And then when they find out that they actually need to have good teamwork, it doesn't go so well. If you've never worked on that very much and all of a sudden you have to do something with colleagues, there's a lot of communication problems. But one of the most dangerous parts, in my opinion, is that if you lack empathy, that interpersonal skill, which is basically trying to imagine what someone else is thinking or feeling and trying to live in their shoes, it really hurts the product development because you're building these tech products for other people. And I think a good example of that is Google Glass. Google built it. It was a very technologically difficult thing that they pulled off. But what they didn't understand is that typical people didn't really want that or need that. And it ended up failing because they lacked that empathy to be able to stand in someone else's shoes.
And are you saying that Google Glass, that product, was affected by a lack of empathy or a lack of women making it or both?
I think that particular product actually had a lot of women engineers on the team who I interviewed at the time. I think it was a lack of empathy for users. But not having women on a team makes a big difference, too. One example was when Apple introduced its health app for the first time in the iPhone. It tracked so many things. It tracked, your sleep and your exercise and your sodium and all these things. It didn't track menstrual cycles. And most women will tell you that Period Trackers is one of the most used health apps on their phone. And I don't know if there were men on Apple's team, but I'd venture to guess that there probably weren't.
You brought up empathy and collaboration. I brought up women because I think America is really thinking about women in tech, especially since that Google engineer got fired for writing that women are unsuited to software engineering. And you said that he was wrong on his biology, but also wrong about working in tech.
So he made this distinction. He said, women care more about feelings and people, and men care more about systems and logic. And we can debate whether or not that is true. I don't think that any scientist would say that you can actually generalize entire populations that broadly. But regardless, tech isn't just about, you know, sure, you need logic and you need rational thinking, but you also need this sort of teamwork. And economists have shown that jobs with a combination of math skills and people skills are by far the fastest growing in the last 15 years, and software engineering is a major one. But I think he missed the fact that the job really does require people skills.
I'm talking again with New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller, who wrote in Upshot this article called Tech's Damaging Myth of the Loner Genius Nerd. Here in Seattle, of course, we have Amazon, for one. Do their products seem to you to lack collaboration or empathy or a woman's influence, any of those things?
I don't want to personally judge any of Amazon's products. I do think one of the interesting examples, though, when we're thinking about empathy and we're thinking about people with diverse experiences like women and other kinds of diversity, is these new digital home assistants. So there's the Amazon Echo, you know, when you ask Alexa to do something for you. And the engineers who are building these things, they really need, these things are, you know, operating in someone's house and family. So they really need to have that sort of empathy to imagine what the user, what their home situation might be like and how this might affect them, and also, you know, diversity to understand, say, you speak to Alexa with an accent, or, you know, say you're in an abusive relationship and you are a woman in a household who needs to keep certain things private from her husband, you know, things like this that really require a diversity of thought. One funny example was when a child ordered a $160 dollhouse on the Echo through Alexa and 4 pounds of cookies. And she just asked Alexa to send it, and Alexa did. And the Amazon box shows up the next day. So, you know, there are parental controls on the Echo. I will say that Amazon had thought of that, but it's important to be able to think about people in other situations. For example, if you're a parent, if the engineers building it aren't a parent, they might not have thought of that.
Right. So part of this is about how yes, there was a time when writing computer code may have been a much more fringy thing, but obviously computing is in our living rooms and computing brings things to our front door.
It's really in so many more parts of our lives, I think, than people realize, and humans are making these decisions. You know, we know that it determines who people date if they're using Match.com or any of those kinds of things. It's also, you know, what kind of loans you get. If you apply for a loan, it's an algorithm that's determining and advising what kind of loan you get. If you send in your resume, it's often an algorithm that's doing the first scan of your resume to decide if it should even be passed on to HR. These are just like all over our lives is affected by the decisions that humans are making, the humans who write the algorithms and make the software. And so, you know, it's really valuable both for those humans to have a diversity of experience and also to have the interpersonal skills and the empathy to think about what their users will need and want.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Do you think that Facebook is it a platform that lacks people skills?
Again, I don't know that I want to comment specifically on judging them myself, but I know, you know, there was a ton of debate during the presidential campaign about the fact that that Facebook was showing people political articles that matched their own viewpoint, and was this, you know, building sort of bubbles where people were unable to see other people's viewpoints. I think, for one, that's an example of how these algorithms really affect our lives in more ways than we might realize. It might affect who we vote for and, you know, who we socialize with and what kind of views we're exposed to. Also, after this criticism, after the election, Facebook started putting more human editors on that algorithm to say that, you know, sometimes we do need these different human points of view to influence the technology.
Yeah, I didn't know until I read your piece, Claire, that Google Plus used to require that users make their name and photo and gender public, and that seemed logical to the, it sounds like, men who wrote that up.
Yep, that was all men on the team who made that decision, that one of the things you had to make public when you signed up for the social network was your gender. And, you know, as many women can tell you, if you say you're a woman online, that opens you to a huge amount of harassment. And, you know, the guy who was leading that project now says if there had been a woman on the team, we wouldn't have made that mistake. But it was a mistake, and it was just because we were blind to that.
Again, this is Claire Kane Miller with the New York Times, and the piece is Tech's Damaging Myth of the Loner Genius Nerd. Clearly something we think about here in the Seattle area, as well as lots of big cities. And you taught me, Claire, that computer programming was originally considered a woman's job.
That's right. There used to be a job called computer, and a computer was a woman. They programmed a lot during World War II. Women were programmers for NASA. It was considered sort of a routine clerical job. It wasn't even a super high-status job, and mostly women were doing it. It wasn't until about the 1960s that it began to professionalize into the job we know today. And as when many things go from a lower status to a professional job, it went from female to male. And at that point is really when men tried to put a stamp of masculinity on it because it had been a woman's job and because it wasn't a job that really fit with a lot of what was considered masculine in occupations at that time, which was, you know, either very physical work, blue-collar work, or, you know, being, you know, a professional athlete or those kind of things. It wasn't that kind of job. And so, you know, the historians who I've talked to who had some really interesting points of view on this said that men really tried to masculinize it in order to get over some of that insecurity about the occupation itself. And what came out was this, you know, this nerd who was a man, maybe with these, like, taped glasses, who was associated with other men, and there wasn't a lot of room for women in that picture.
Do computer engineers who deal more directly with users make more money or less money than engineers who work behind the scenes on something like data storage?
The ones who work on the parts of the product that users interact with, they make less money. Those are called front-end engineers, and there is a bias in Silicon Valley and, you know, Silicon Valley writ large, including the Seattle area, that those are less valuable jobs, and that's why they're paid less. They're also more likely to be done by women, as many jobs that pay less are and as many jobs that involve interaction with people are. But the people who I've talked to who have worked in tech and have done both jobs say, in fact, they're equally challenging. And in many ways, that front-end engineering is even more challenging than the back-end. But it's yet again one of these biases about both interpersonal skills and about women that the tech industry has just perpetuated.
So, Claire, to sum this up and for people maybe just tuning in, will you just highlight your main point of how the myth of the loner genius nerd in tech is not just about this famous Google memo, but it really affects a lot of our lives?
That's right. So we have this myth that the people who make technology are these loner nerds. And first of all, it's never been true. Second of all, it really deters talented people from the industry. And this is not just women. It's all sorts of people, including men who don't think that sounds like a great job description and who don't identify with that. And the more that this happens, the more that we deter these, you know, a broader group of people from the industry, the more that these products that affect every part of our lives are going to be built by people with only one set of experiences. And that's not going to serve any of us well.
We might even push in our children who seem to fit the stereotype, channel them toward the computer sciences and other kids away from that.
That's right. So, you know, when there are kids who don't really love to socialize, who aren't super comfortable out on the playground, but they really like computers and math and building, what parents do and what teachers do, which makes a lot of sense, is say, oh, maybe you should consider computers and engineering. But what happens is that it just perpetuates it. It's not like those kids shouldn't go into computers and engineering. That's wonderful. But what can happen is computer science classes, which they don't right now, can start to teach a broader variety of subjects to start to do team projects instead of just assigning solo projects, to assign some liberal arts courses where you're thinking about, you know, maybe the history of technology and where you're thinking about some of these ethical questions about, you know, who algorithms are biased against, and, you know, teaching some of those skills along with the coding skills.
So much to think about here. Claire Kane Miller is a reporter with Upshot for the New York Times, and we are tweeting out a link right now to her article headlined Tech's Damaging Myth of the Loner Genius Nerd. So relevant here in Seattle area. So great to talk with you, Claire. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on KUOW's The Record, a University of Washington expert will answer your questions about Monday's solar eclipse. So what do you want to know? Tell us. Record@KUOW.org. Email us record@KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's Lakeview Cemetery on Capitol Hill closed today over fears that the monument to Confederate soldiers on its grounds could become a flashpoint for protest. The cemetery tells us they have closed for weather before, but never closed for safety concerns. No news about whether anything's going to happen to that monument. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray says he wants it to go, but it's private property, so there's not much anyone can do other than the owner of the plot. That is the local chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. An employee at Lakeview also says they have turned away 25 Bruce Lee fans so far this morning, some of them very upset. We talked yesterday on this show about whether a statue of George Washington at the University of Washington should be removed or maybe have a plaque added to it telling you that Washington bought and owned slaves, hundreds of slaves. Well, after that conversation, we sent KUOW producer Matt Martin to the George Washington statue near Red Square to ask what people think of it.
I just think it's a good reminder of bad things. But, I mean, he also did great things, so tearing it down for the one bad thing probably isn't the best thing to do.
I don't think I care whether they remove it or not. I mean, if somebody feels like it represents oppression, then I would say, yeah, we should remove it, because why have it?
I have never actually thought about it. So, yeah, I don't know. Probably have to change the name of the state if it was that big of a deal.
This person may have not acted in a way that, according to like modern ethical values, would have been considered good, but that doesn't mean that we should just discount their legacy entirely, I guess. I think it's just a good idea in general to look critically at people considered heroes, because I feel like you can consider someone a hero and not think everything they did was heroic.
As Matt was talking to those people, a high school student wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt came up and started taping his own sign to the base of the statue. The sign said, slave owner.
So I see you're adding a sign here.
Yes. I'm Ewan McCurney, and even if you respect George Washington, you have to recognize that he is a slave owner, or at least, you know, put something on this that you know, and slavery, which is why I came here. That especially with the violence in Charlottesville and stuff, it has to be at least acknowledged, and George Washington should be in museums. However, do we really want in public parks celebrating a slave owner? I really don't think so.
A UW employee took that sign down about 20 minutes later. We heard from you on this one, too. Rachel writes, maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation if the number of statues and monuments to historical white figures were outnumbered by monuments of people of color, civil rights heroes, and the region's Native American heritage. We need more monuments that honor the memories of the oppressed and shed light on the reality facing the people of color on whose backs the country was founded. And Danny writes to us saying, Confederate statues do not just represent slavery, they more importantly represent anti-federal government, and therefore are anti-American. George Washington represents the federal government. Confederacy flags and statues represent a fractured country, not the Union of States. This is the bigger narrative. Thank you for that, Danny. His note raises another question. Do our public statues need to be pro-American? What do you think of all of this? We'd love to hear from you, so talk to us. Send your email to record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, and our phone number is 206-221-3663 for our voicemail, 221-3663. Put us in your phone, call us anytime. It's KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. Last year, more than 27,000 refugees entering the United States were school-age children. many of them were not ready for the classroom. For nearly a decade, a resettlement program has been running a summer school in Tukwila for refugee kids to help get them ready to learn. From KUOW's immigration team, Ruby DeLuna reports.
Inside Showalter Middle School, students are concentrating on cards filled with pictures of animals.
Okay, our next word, this is a hard one. Can you guys say it with me? Guinea pig. Guinea pig.
They put a marker on the animal being called out. They do this until someone gets...
Bingo! Wow!
The students are playing bingo for the first time. 11-year-old Ala Bazara was born in Syria. Her native language is Arabic. Last December, she and her family resettled in Seattle. Initially, Bazara didn't want to come to summer school because she didn't speak any English.
Like, everybody laughing to me.
Clearly, she's learned some. And now she has a different take on summer school.
Like, it's cool. Summer school, it's cool.
Because learning is fun.
Play soccer. And we learn English and go library.
Even though she's a beginning reader in English, she checked out a book, a children's book about Islam. For Bazara and her 33 classmates, English is their second, even third language. They come from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Afghanistan, Iraq, Nepal. Some have had little schooling, partly because their families were fleeing war. That makes learning a new language a challenge.
It's much easier, even if you've written in Arabic, which is not the same alphabet, to learn how to write in English if you have previous reading and writing experience in your mother tongue.
Stevie Hamill is with the International Rescue Committee, the refugee resettlement agency running the summer school program. Hamill and her team develop lesson plans to help students build vocabulary and math skills. They include field trips to meet librarians, police officers, and firefighters. The program also teaches them soft skills to help when they start school in the fall.
Things like lining up, raising your hands, sitting down for an extended amount of time, how we act in the cafeteria.
Hamill says teachers are trained to watch how students are doing emotionally, too.
A way that that might play out is I'm teaching a lesson and all of a sudden a student's under a desk and really, like, quite visibly shaken, and I have no idea why.
So instead of assuming the kid is acting out and responding with a reprimand, Hamill says she would ask,
why don't you feel safe right now? How can I help you in this situation?
Hamill says they're not trying to be mental health counselors, but to help students get to a point where they feel safe again. At the end of the 5-week-long summer program, the younger students show the audience what they've been learning.
The horn on the bus goes beep, 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 beep.
Ala Bazara's mother, Imtisal, watches with the other parents and teachers. She's beaming.
What I hope is for my kids to fulfill their dreams, and that's what I hope for all kids all over the world. Just when they have a dream, they can achieve it.
And we are proud to present certificates of completion for IRC Summer School to our secondary students, starting
after
with
the acknowledgments and praise, the students walk up to the stage to receive their diploma and a new backpack.
Allah!
It's a moment full of pride and expectation. In September, these kids will start school and navigate a new chapter in their lives. In Tukwila, I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Was Michael Bennett eclipsing the Seahawks game? More about the eclipse later. Let's talk Seahawks right now. If you watch the Seahawks play the Vikings tomorrow night, you're going to see something like this.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
And you'll see fans and coaches and players standing to salute the flag, but not Seahawks defensive lineman Michael Bennett. Last week, Bennett sat on the team's bench during the anthem with a towel on his head. He said later that he was reacting to the violence and hatred in Virginia and to the competing demonstrations here in Seattle. Here's Bennett explaining himself to CNN.
I'm not protesting the flag. I'm actually trying to honor what we're supposed to be honoring, the freedom of America, the equality of America, the justice for all, and the liberty. Those are the things I'm trying to remind people that we all fought for, the forefathers. We said we would fight against terrorists, domestic and foreign. And right now, there's a whole bunch of domestic terrorism, domestic hate going on between your race, the gender, all this stuff going on because of somebody's the skin and color. So I want to bring up those issues and create those conversations and create and get people off their butt.
My next guest sees a problem with Bennett trying to get people off our butts. News Tribune sports columnist John McGrath. Welcome to KUOW, John.
Thanks, Bill. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. You wrote that Bennett should salute the flag or quit the team. Why do you say that?
I think it's once you leave the locker room, Bill, and the time you spend on the field until you go back to the locker room, it's about a team. And in the Seahawks case, it would be 53 guys being on the same page. You have the rest of the season, the rest of the week, the rest of your life to work for promote social causes and what you find to be more important than football. But for 3 hours and whatever it is, 3.5 hours on Sunday afternoon, this sounds crass. There's nothing more important than football. you're putting your teammates, some of your teammates, in a position of being divisive. For instance, now I see where Doug Baldwin is thinking about sitting on Sunday and joining Michael. What if you have, for instance, an undrafted free agent who right now is desperate just to land a roster spot, and he feels very, very strongly about these issues too? Does he also join them, or is he forced to think, man, I don't want to rock the boat. I better just kind of mind my own business.
Well, John, I haven't seen any of Bennett's teammates complain. In fact, the head coach, Pete Carroll, said he's okay with it, and it's Carroll's job on the line. So what's the problem?
I wouldn't expect any of them to complain publicly, so that doesn't surprise me. And as for Pete's response, I'm kind of still trying to figure out what he meant. He said he wants all his players to stand, but in this case, he's okay with Michael sitting. It's either one or the other, right?
Well, what about the idea that I'm Pete Carroll, I think we ought to stand, and on this team, people who disagree get to sit? How is that a contradiction?
It just seems like if he says, I want everybody to stand, and then is okay with somebody sitting, I just think that's an inherent contradiction. But I guess I'm not, whatever.
Is it a disunity that is hurting the team? I mean, the Seahawks won that game by 31 points.
Well, I don't think that had anything to do with it. It's a disunity that could potentially hurt the team. We saw what happened last year on the sideline when Richard Sherman had two separate meltdowns. That definitely hurt the team. I just think in football and in all sports, basically, but let's just talk about football, unity is so important. Being on the same page is so important. And I respect the hell out of Michael Bennett. I think he's got a future if he so chooses to go into public service and to go into politics. I think he's got real potential to be a difference maker. But like I say, on Sunday afternoon, his job is to play football. And he says, well, this is bigger than football. And I humbly disagree.
How do you know, though, that this, if there even is a disagreement among the team, and you said they wouldn't express it publicly, but we don't know whether there is or not, how do you know that's the kind of thing? I'm no football player. So, I mean, I could imagine I come out, they play the anthem, I stand, somebody's behind me or isn't, and then, I mean, it's my job. I'm very well paid to, when the whistle blows, to focus on sacks and kick returns. And what's so hard about that for somebody even who disagrees with Michael Bennett?
I guess I'm just kind of repeating myself here, Bill. I just think it's potentially divisive, even though it didn't look like it Saturday. This is just the beginning. Like I say, Doug Baldwin's talking about joining him, and other players are going to talk about joining him. And what if you have a situation where 12 guys are sitting? And I know it doesn't seem like a big deal, but every little thing in football matters. It's all symbolic in terms of a team. And I respect everything Michael Bennett said, the reasons why I fully endorse. But when it comes time to take the field, everybody needs to be unified. That's the problem I had with sitting. I don't have any problem at all being demonstrating. However you want to demonstrate is up to you, and I have no problem with that. It's just the fact it was, as a football player, nothing's bigger than the team and nothing is bigger than the game at that time on Sunday afternoon.
News Tribune sports columnist John McGrath, your column took a bold stand. The last word in your column was quit. How did your readers react?
I'd say, Bill, about 75-80% were not pleased with it.
Really? I'm surprised.
Yeah, there were there was some support, but the overwhelming attitude was what you've kind of been underscoring this morning. And then some of them were politely and written in a civil tone, which I appreciate. And others were not written in a polite and civil tone. The one that really got under my skin to a certain extent was from my ex-wife, who said, "Your daughter's really angry with you. It took you 20 years to get her attention. You finally did it."
Wow.
I know. That kind of hurt a little bit. But and then there was one on Deadspin. Have you ever checked out Deadspin?
Yes.
It's a good site. It's a little bit raunchy. But there's some
funny,
there's some,
too.
But very funny, yeah, very clever, and they really scorched me. And then, of course, they have comments, addendums to their posts, and all those people scorched me. And then on Twitter, there were more than 100 references, and all of them 100% scorched me. So I got a lot of I got a lot of negative feedback.
I'm actually surprised because that it was so negative, John, because I can understand somebody just wanting to enjoy a football game without having to think about neo-Nazis. I mean, that's relatable, but it seems like Michael Bennett is saying that there are more important things than distraction-free anthems. And you know, this is kind of the power of sports, John, that we can take a game of fun and take it so seriously that a player taking a moment before the game even starts, not during the game, but just before the game, being peacefully, passively, meaningful in a way that the viewer doesn't even have to notice, much less agree with, even that feels disruptive to us in the world of sports. I think that's why this resonates so much.
Yeah, and it's been that way for I guess, since the beginning of time. But I remember, Bill, when JFK was assassinated, I was in the third grade. And it happened on a Friday afternoon. On sometime between Friday and Sunday, Pete Rozelle, who had been roommates at University of San Francisco with Pierre Salinger, who was JFK's press secretary, Rozelle calls Salinger and asks, should we play Sunday? And Salinger famously responded, "Well, the president would have wanted you to." Hmm. And that would, which is preposterous, but Pete took him at his word, and the NFL played games on Sunday. The AFL, which was the rogue league in those days, they were the Outlaws, and Al Davis and all those guys, they didn't play. The NCAA canceled all their games, they didn't play, but the NFL played these games. And it turned out to be almost therapeutic because the fans, and we didn't know what was going on, right? We still don't know what went on. But the players were all in a daze. And with one game, the Bears were going to play the Steelers at Pittsburgh, and they're on the bus going to the stadium. And as that was Sunday morning when Jack Ruby shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, this is playing basically live on the radio, and there's half the team is in the back of the bus listening to it. And George Halas was the Bears coach in those days, goes back to the bus, says, "What's going on?" And they said, "Well, coach, this guy who killed Kennedy just got shot and killed himself." And Halas grabs the radio and smashes it on the bus floor and says, "You got to get ready for football," and then walked away. So that was—I don't know where I was going with that story, but I still found it kind of interesting. It was 1963, and issues like that were still—you know—was at what point does football mean everything, and other things? At what point are the lines crossed a little bit?
Well, I'll leave you with a final thought on that question, John, because we get this tweet from Amy, who's listening to us and says, if a Seahawks job is to play football, nothing is bigger than that on Sunday afternoon. Why do they play the national anthem?
Right. Well, that's been asked for forever. I think it's in memory of my late mother. She would always cry when they played the national anthem. And I always found that touching, and I would sort of cry too because she was crying. I don't know how many fans take it that seriously, but there's just something to me very touching and about being able to take 2 minutes before a game and think about our country.
Well, Michael Bennett will have another chance tomorrow night at CenturyLink Field in Seattle when the Seahawks play the Minnesota Vikings. Bennett has said he will not stand for the national anthem, quote, until everything's equal, everybody has justice, everybody has freedom. So he may be sitting for a long time. We'll see. News Tribune columnist John McGrath. Good to talk with you about this. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
We're going to answer your eclipse questions in just a moment. Stay tuned to KUOW. At KUOW, we're taking your eclipse curiosities now at area code 206-543-5869, 543-5869. Yes, on Monday, the sky will darken as the moon briefly covers the sun. A solar eclipse, and here in the Northwest, we can only see the total eclipse in parts of Oregon or Idaho. But even here in the Puget Sound area, about 90% of the sun will be hidden. So what's that going to be like? Where should you view it? How should you view it? Let us answer your questions. What else you got? Ask us now at 206-543-5869. We have, with the answers, Erica Harnett, Research Associate Professor of Earth and Space Science at University of Washington. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
Welcome. You're going to Oregon.
Yes, I am. I'm going to Eastern Oregon.
Any reservations about that?
Oh, there are some. Yes, I'm a little worried. They've been telling us, you know, the precautions we have to take, and I'm here reading, you know, bring gas, bring water, bring food, bring a fire extinguisher, bring a shovel, and I'm thinking, why exactly? What am I getting myself into?
Yes. Well, I do want to find out more about your Oregon trip in a moment. I just want to set this up for listeners, how much this means to people. I had an interview last month with a former NPR reporter and now an eclipse chaser named David Barron, and he waxed on about how life-changing this event is. We got into why, and we got into the idea of looking at the moon and the sun. Listen to this.
During a total eclipse, the blue sky gets ripped away, and you can actually look up toward the center of the solar system, see the planets and the sun together. And again, the great paradox is it's only when the sun is hidden that you actually can see the sun. Because when the moon covers the bright surface of the sun, that's the only time you can look at the sun with the naked eye. And you will see what surrounds the sun, which is called the solar corona. It's the sun's atmosphere. And it is the most beautiful thing you have ever seen in the sky.
Now, Erica, we got a few emails about that from listeners who heard Barron say you can look at the sun with the naked eye, even the solar corona. And they wanted to know, is that right?
During the totality, yes, that is true. But you have to be someplace where totality is occurring, and only at the time of totality is it safe for you to look at the sky without special protection.
Totality is when the moon is completely covering the sun except for that little corona outside it. This is what's happening. This is what you can see in Oregon.
This is what you're going to be seeing in Oregon. And if you're looking at some of the graphics that are being being produced and being displayed, it's where they show this black swath where you see 100% of the sun being covered. So that at that point, the entire visible disk of the sun that produces most of the light is covered. And therefore, that's when it is safe to look at the sun with the naked eye.
How long does that time period last?
It's going to vary about where you are in the United States. In Oregon, it's going to last about 2 minutes and 10 seconds. For the people on the East Coast who are in totality, that time is going to be about 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Okay. So about 2 minutes, you can look at that spectacle straight with a naked eye.
Exactly.
We do, we are getting glasses for the rest of us, right?
Yes.
And so we have a question from a listener who wants to know, where can you get eclipse glasses now?
At this point, most places I have seen are sold out. All of the vendors, the approved vendors that I have seen online are sold out, even if you could get them in time. Pacific Science Center was selling them. They are completely sold out. I've heard the Museum of Flight is sold out. I have heard that the Seattle Public Libraries might be doing some events. They don't have any at the moment, but they've reserved some back, and that some of the Seattle Public Libraries might have glasses day of. There might also be some events that have reserved some back, so that if visitors come for the event, they might have some that people can share during the event.
Okay. Is there a way to tell the real glasses from the fake ones that we've heard about that don't protect you?
Yeah. The best way to do it is to start sort of gradually, if you're unsure, is put them on and sort of increment up the brighter the source that you're looking at. If you put them on and look at, say, a very bright light in your house and you cannot see that light at all, you're getting close. and then you'll want to maybe look at a reflection of the sun on, say, like a car hood or something outside. And if you cannot see that sunlight being reflected off of that surface, you're even closer, so that you can start sort of incrementing up if you're unsure.
Okay, let's take another question from Kirsten in Tacoma. Hi, Kirsten.
Hey there.
What's your question for Erica Harnett from the University of Washington?
So my question is, why is the path of totality so narrow? My understanding is that it's about 100 miles wide, and that seems incredibly narrow for a planet as big as the sun.
So the reason why it's so narrow, it's the size of the moon's shadow, and it's that the moon is really so far away from us that shadow is going to end up being pretty small, and the size of the moon is just right that for certain times of its orbit it can completely block the sun, but it's still, the moon is quite a bit smaller than the Earth. So that its shadow is going to be a lot smaller. If you think about lunar eclipses, which is the exact opposite, which when the Earth passes between the moon and the sun, that happens, it's much easier to see, many more people see it, because the moon shadow is so much bigger the Earth's shadow is so much bigger than the moon. You see that shadow is much larger, and so a lot more people can see that lunar eclipse.
Thanks for the question, Kirsten. Here's something that, if I got this right, this is amazing to me. If you're, let's say you're not going to go to Oregon, okay, like you are, you're going to Oregon, but if we stay here where we're not in the path of totality, where do we view the eclipse when we're here? Because I heard that there's a place where we shouldn't do it.
Well, this is based on my 20 years of experience of watching partial eclipses in Seattle. So I'm a lifetime Seattle resident, lifetime science and space nerd. So any partial eclipse we have ever had, I have gone out and tried to watch. And one of the things I have noticed is for every single one of them, that if it was not cloudy to begin with, it is cloudy during part of the eclipse. Because what will happen is, as the moon starts to move in front of the sun, you'll actually notice a decrease in the air temperature.
How much?
At 95%, which is what you could get in Washington State, you could experience almost like 10 to 15, maybe even up to 20 degrees decrease in temperature change. Uh-huh. It depends on, you know, a lot of conditions of what's going on in the wind. There's a lot of things, but you could get a very sizable change in the temperature. And even with a few degree temperature change, as the beginning of eclipse starts, what I have noticed is that it will change the dew point in the air. And because we're near water, we're near Puget Sound, every single time I've gone through this is a marine layer forms over Puget Sound and then starts blowing in. And then suddenly what was a clear view of the partial eclipse becomes a clouded view.
Because a bank of clouds is going to roll in and block our view of the eclipse?
Yes.
That is amazing to me. So what do we do with that information? Stay away from Puget Sound.
I would say if you have the opportunity to get away from Puget Sound so you can try to avoid a marine layer if it forms, I would do that. That's why when I knew this was coming, my first thing I thought was, we're going east of the mountains. Because I wanted some mountains blocking me and a moraine layer.
I suppose if you were in the foothills, you could be that would be an amazing view to be
above the moraine layer and be able to see the partial eclipse.
Fog below, partial eclipse above. That's cool. We have another question for Erica Harnett from University of Washington. Gail in Seattle, what's your question? Hi, Gail. What's your eclipse question? May have lost Gail. She's pondering that cloud bank, and I don't blame her. So what about the 90-ish percent, between 90 and 95%? What's it going to look like here in Seattle, basically?
You should notice a significant decrease in light. In the path of totality, it will appear that it's almost like night, but at the same time, it feels like there's going to be a sunset all around us. That goes back to the mention about being in totality. It's this very exciting, almost magical feel because you're seeing something that's so unexpected, so different. Seeing a sunset in all directions is what I've heard it explained as.
Wow.
People in Seattle won't see that, but they should see it get darker. So it's a little bit hard because our eyes do adjust to the decrease in light.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be noticeable, and animals will also respond to the decrease, and they might, even at 95%, they might start acting as if it's starting to become nighttime and do whatever their nighttime rituals are.
Dogs walking 3 times in a circle lying down.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Dale in Seattle. Dale, what's your question for Erica Harnett from the UW?
Hi.
Hi.
We're going to be traveling down to Oregon, me and family, and we have the safety glasses. And I'm wondering when we can take off the safety glasses, because I've heard if you still get a little direct sunlight, you know, it can still be dangerous.
Yes, that's true.
How do I know?
So the best way to tell is that right before totality, you will see something called Bailey's beads form. And it's just a fancy name for a little bit of light will actually be able to move through valleys on the moon. So you'll see little spots of light. You'll be seeing the moon as you're watching this. You'll be seeing the moon covering the sun. And right before totality, you'll see little spots of light. When those spots of light goes to a single light, beam of light, it was called the diamond ring. When those all disappear, that should be the time when it is safe to remove your glasses if you are in totality and be able to look up. And you will be able to see, if you can see an extended wispy atmosphere that appears very unworldly, then it's definitely safe because you cannot see this corona, this solar atmosphere, if the sun is not completely blocked.
Bailey's beads to diamond ring, glasses off.
Yeah.
I love it. We have a question from Shannon who says, please tell us how to create and use a pinhole box instead of only talking about the glasses, which can damage eyes.
That is a great question. It's actually really easy to make a pinhole viewer. You can take a cereal box. Cut up a cereal box, or a piece of cardboard, and any sort of small object like the point on a compass, you can punch a hole in it. It's a little bit of testing to see how big. You don't want it too big, but too small is also a problem. So I found like a compass that you use for making drawing circles.
Yep.
Punch a hole in the cardboard there, and then just hold it up, and maybe like about 3-4 feet from the ground, and it should create a nice projection image. There are even pictures of leaves. If you get underneath a leafy tree, that leaves on a very leafy tree can actually filter, and you'll see a whole bunch of images of the eclipse occurring underneath the tree. So if you've around some leafy trees, you don't even need anything, possibly.
Erica Harnett from University of Washington is here. More of a commoner question, I guess. Michelle says, I've read traffic on I-5 is going to be bad. True
it
or not?
It probably is. There are reports that a large number of people in the greater Seattle area are thinking of driving down morning of to the Portland.
Oh, bad idea?
I don't think that's going to be a good idea. That's probably going to be there's going to be a lot of traffic.
If you don't mind telling us, what are you going to do in Oregon? Where are you going to be?
We're going to be in Eastern Oregon near Madras. So Madras is sort of the center of all of this because it's right on the center of path of totality. There's a lot of different NASA-affiliated events occurring.
But you're going to camp out days in advance? What's your plan?
We actually have... I knew I was planning for this 2.5 years ago, so I actually have hotel rooms in Bend.
Okay, got it.
And so we do have to then travel into the path of totality, but we've been... The group that we're going to be working with, they're going to be launching high-altitude balloons. Really, it's to make atmospheric observations of the atmosphere as totality starts to change. change, the temperature of the atmosphere, and just record those. I'm also trying to get pictures of the shadow moving across the Earth, hopefully. It's really meant as a learning experience for high schools and college students to learn how to build instruments for high altitude balloons. And it was really sort of an event of excitement to get everybody into this and then build capacity for that type of experimental process.
So you've got a hotel room in Bend. What would you do if you had Jeff Bezos money? I mean, could you, like, I imagine him being in low Earth orbit, just following the eclipse around.
Yeah, that would be cool, being able to follow it with a plane.
Yeah.
There's going to probably be a lot of planes. There's also going to be a lot of balloons up in the air, too.
Really?
Yeah, there are probably over 100 teams that are going to be across the United States that are going to be launching high-altitude balloons during this time. So there's going to be a lot of balloons in the air. Yeah, but I've also heard being on the ground is also phenomenal because of this, how much it changes the light. And the fact that you're looking up, it's day, you're looking up near the sun, but you can see stars and planets come out. So I think while being able to chase the shadow is interesting, I think from what I've heard, because I've never been through this before, that being on the ground is probably even more so.
That makes it even better.
Yeah.
Just us on the ground. It's enough.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing. And finally, Erica, eventually eclipses aren't going to happen anymore?
Eventually they will not. That it's going to be so far into the future that most of us are probably not going to care. Say in about 1 million years, the moon is actually slowly spiraling away from the Earth.
Uh-huh.
So eventually it will be far enough away from the Earth that it won't be able to completely block out the sun during this time period. The moon will still pass between us and the sun, but it will appear so smaller than the sun. So we won't be able to see whoever is here.
Yeah, you're right. I will slowly, I'll gradually be caring less over the next 1 million years or so. Erica Harnett, Research Associate Professor of Earth and Space Science at University of Washington. She's going to be in, is it Warm Springs, Oregon?
Culver, Oregon,
to see the total solar eclipse. She has not offered you a ride. If you're in the Puget Sound area, you can stay and get about 90% plus coverage.
Yeah.
Show starts at about 9 o'clock, right? It takes a while.
It takes about an hour and a half.
It takes about an hour and a half.
10 o'clock is the time. 10 to 10:15 is when you want to go watch.
All right. Start looking at 9, but 10, 10:15, it gets exciting. Erica, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's The Record.